For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello and welcome to the Folklore Podcast. I'm Mark Norman, folklore researcher and author. Today we're going off tangentially to one of the adjacent areas of interest to pure folklore to explore an aspect of the world of Gothic literature. From penny dreadfuls and chapbooks to penny bloods and Gothic novels, and from classics such as Bronte to lesser known works, there are many ways in which the role of the woman is often read as monstrous. She might be mad and confined to her room. She might be stuffing dead bodies into meat pies. Or she might be a literal she-wolf. Today's guest, Dr. Nicole Dittmer, has a particular interest in female monstrosity, both in 19th century British literature and that from America in the 17th century. Nicole is an adjunct professor in the field of Gothic studies at the College of New Jersey, who gained her PhD in early to mid 19th century Gothic studies and medical sciences from Manchester Metropolitan University in the UK. In this interview, originally recorded in 2023, we focus on her monograph Monstrous Women in the Victorian Gothic, but Nicole has also published on penny dreadfuls, penny bloods, and ecofeminism. She spoke with literature correspondent Hilary Wilson about the topic of monstrous women.
Hi, this is Hilary Wilson here for the Folklore Podcast. I'm here to interview Nicole Dittmer about her monograph, Monstrous Women and Ecofeminism in the Victorian Gothic, 1837 through 1871. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Hilary. Thank you for having me.
So could you tell us a little bit about the subject of your monograph?
Well, at its bare basis, it's about monstrous women in the early to mid-Victorian period. And I want to note that I use the term monstrous quite loosely. It is not actually about truly monstrous women, as in vampires per se. It is more about women that are classified as monstrous because they don't follow the ideologies of Victorian expectations. Mm-hmm. So I do look at women such as mad women, criminal or femme fatale women. And then ultimately, there is a bit of a crossover into actual monsters through our she-wolves.
So when you are terming monstrous, it's more of a label that would be placed upon them rather than a literal depiction of what they are, for the most part.
Oh, absolutely. They're what we call material semiotic figurations in Gothic. Basically, they're integrations of rejected ideologies, rejected social constructs, and claims for personal agency, mm-hmm. wrapped up in a characterization in Gothic literature.
So within this, you focus on some of the better known stories that have come out of this time period. You have quite the section on Wuthering Heights, which is likely to be familiar to most of our listeners.
Yes, absolutely. I have, under my Mad Women chapter, I have Wuthering Heights by Bronte. I have the offset, or what's called the penny dreadful of Wuthering Heights, called The Wronged Wife or The Heart of Hate, which is I want to say essentially it's a replication almost directly of Jane Eyre, which is also in that chapter. In my femme fatale or criminal chapter, I do focus on Lady Audley's secret, and then also the String of Pearls, or what is now known nowadays as Sweeney Todd. And then in my final chapter, I focus on The White Wolf of the Harz Mountains, The Grey Wolf by McDonald's, and also Wagner the Werewolf by Reynolds.
And within Wuthering Heights, it was quite interesting to read about, because as you said in our little conversation earlier, so much of the analysis that's come out around Wuthering Heights focuses on Heathcliff, who is a bit of a mysterious figure, rather than Kathy, who is much more apparent there on the page. You know, we get a lot more time with her, and we get a lot more of an analysis, so to speak, you know, of her characterization. Why do you think so much is focusing on Heathcliff rather than Kathy?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I'm not going to reject Heathcliff as a character. Well, he is an absolutely fascinating character. He's an amalgamation of an apt for analysis, for everything from primarily his gender. He's a male who is not part of the direct patriarchal society. He's an orphan. So right from there, you have that. His question of race is also apt for analysis in there, because it's never truly depicted where he is from, who what his lineage is, who his parentage is. There are, you know, doubts or questions whether he's Earnshaw's child or not, or whether his parentage is from someone in Liverpool, unbeknownst to the reader. He is also a psychological nightmare. If you read him using any of our old psychoanalysts, such as Freud, for example, you can write pages and pages and pages on Heathcliff without running out of material. So I think that is more so, and never mind, you know, he's depicted as the Byronic hero, the brooding Gothic male character who's stuck in this tragic romance that's unresolved, and it's truly unrequited. So, like I said, Heathcliff is fabulous, but he's not the only fabulous one in the book, so to say. Kathy, there is analysis on her. There are some depictions. I think Gilbert and Gubar actually talked about her in their Mad Women in the Attic book. Mm-hmm. So they did do an analysis on Kathy and her behavior. I have read stories. I think Martin Willis was another who talks specifically about Kathy as the spectral child, where he talked about her her restrictions in the way of when they introduce her as that spectral figure. Her books were identified, and her books were used as a barrier to restrict her from getting back into the house, which Willis talked about how that was society's way of rejecting her or restricting her from education. So there is analysis about her, but there's not an excessive amount. And I just felt that she was, everything that she's gone through throughout the entire first half of the novel was ripe for the picking, so to speak.
Yeah, and you had a pretty interesting, you know, analysis of her and, you know, of the book itself. You know, there is a really interesting, almost pagan element, you know, to the way that, you know, the landscape is described and how it responds to Kathy and her moods.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Would you like to share a little bit of that with us?
Sure. And that is the whole concept of the landscape or the atmosphere mirroring Kathy's behavior. That is taken very much so from an eco-Gothic or even an eco-feminist approach. Because since 1974, when the term ecofeminism first came out, there was this whole dichotomy of woman in nature, men in culture. Men were supremely aligned with the organized station of culture, while women were seen as aligned with nature. Mm-hmm. They were assumed as chaotic, unstable, and metamorphic due to their reproduction or their reproductive abilities. So women were always classified as being part of nature. And that's where ecofeminism has come in. And, you know, there are advocates that are against that woman nature alignment. And then there are allies for that woman nature alignment. And I use the more so the allied approach in that text. And what I do is I focus on Kathy and how her psychological decline mm-hmm. is reflected in mostly the atmosphere. Yeah. There's the primary scene, which everybody knows, where Kathy is having a discussion with Nellie. It's after Edgar proposes to her. And she turns to Nellie and she tries to explain why she's going to marry Edgar, even though you could see that she's quite conflicted. She wants to marry Edgar for the station of societal station in life. Mm-hmm. However, you know, her true love resides within Heathcliff. So at that point where she has that moment, that sentence that I am Heathcliff, she identifies, and then Heathcliff runs away. After she realizes that Heathcliff has overheard what she was saying and decides to escape out into the wilderness, it's very clear in the novel how the storm outside rages. It was calm until that point, until Kathy had her emotional upheaval, until she had her break. The storm rages. It continues after midnight. As Kathy is slowly descending into the preliminary stages of madness, the winds pick up more, the rain becomes torrential, and at the breaking point, even a branch breaks through the house. So, I mean, I thought that was a perfect representation of how the environment is aligned with Kathy. And you see that later on, too, in her, up until her death scene. She desires to be back out on the moors. That's where she has her freedom. That's her place of what Stacey Alamo calls the undomesticated space or area. She wants that agency back. She wants her freedom, and she can only achieve that by being a part of nature.
And at the very beginning of the book as well, you know, with our narrator there in Kathy's room, you know, that storm is almost mirrored, you know, as mm-hmm. he's trying to sleep, looking through, you know, the books that she's annotated.
Absolutely. And he's dealing with the storm that's going on outside while you have the spectral child of Kathy attempting to enter the house again. And again, she's being restricted. She's being forced outward. So she becomes violent. It's funny because he draws blood from her during the point where the storm is again at its peak. So you'll see it all throughout the novel. There are these moments of atmospheric events.
Yeah. And you know, that's to a lesser extent present within Mrs. Lovett with String of Pearls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought it was really interesting. I wasn't familiar with that. Is chapbook appropriate for it?
It's more of a, during the time frame, I believe is 1847. That would be considered a penny blood at that time.
So within the penny blood, I wasn't terribly familiar with it. I grew up on the musical. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting, you know, reading about the analysis of how Mrs. Lovett is originally portrayed within that, you know, since she's portrayed quite differently within the musical and then within adaptations like Tim Burton's.
Absolutely. Mrs. Lovett has a different environmental impact that occurs with her. She performs according to what we call the effective environment. It's basically her surroundings inform her behavior and her mm-hmm. actions. And at the same time, she also informs her surroundings. So in the original text, The String of Pearls, Mrs. Lovett, she's a lower middle class woman. However, her character replicates the expectations of middle class society. She's not exactly an elegant lady per se. However, she is a shopkeeper. She's an owner. In her shop itself, it's very much illustrated or exhibited as a domestic environment. She's there, she's making food for her patrons. She's also depicted as incredibly attractive. She fits the standards of what they call the Victorian angel. Mm-hmm. She has her whole aesthetic is appealing. However, it is noted in the text too by some of her patrons that there's something wrong with her. They can tell that there's something suspect. I believe they say while she is friendly to everyone, she has an effigy appearance of a mannequin. Like there's something almost possessing her.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's actually absolutely brilliant the way they depicted her. And the reason I started talking about the effective environment in her situation, because unlike Kathy, where Kathy has a psychological break, it's reflected in the external environment. Mrs. Lovett is actually affected by her internal environment. Mm-hmm. And mostly I use her cellar as the grotesque cave, because you have all of the horrors occurring in her cellar right before beneath her bake shop. This is where people are, well, they're not being murdered there, but they're being transported there to be turned into meat pies. So you have the grotesque of her surroundings kind of influencing her behavior. So while she has the perfect visage of Victorian Angel, she's harboring that destructive criminal underneath the surface.
Mm-hmm. And so that becomes this beautiful metaphor with, you know, her own psyche being depicted through the horrors of the cellar.
Absolutely.
You know, the inner workings. And it's, you know, fascinating to see what a strong character, you know, she is, you know, within the Penny Blood, as opposed to later depictions that focus more primarily upon Sweeney.
Oh, definitely. And that's another thing is while researching the Mrs. Lovett character, there is not a significant amount. I think I found a handful of texts. I think Rowan McWilliam, Robert Mack, those were two of the primaries that I used for any type of academic approach. Mm-hmm. However, Mrs. Lovett, she's hard pressed to find information. And when you do find information, like you said, for the Tim Burton versions, the Stephen Sondheim version, she's more of a lesser apprentice to Sweeney Todd. And as such, they kind of turn her into a caricature of what her original character should be.
Yeah, which is odd because even within, you know, those adaptations, she is the one who has the idea. Mm-hmm. You know, she is the machination that, you know, Sweeney then gets into. So she's depicted as an apprentice, even though, you know, she is the mind behind it.
Absolutely. And that's another fascinating thing about the original text. It's never depicted how their relationship started. It's unknown whether it was Sweeney Todd's idea, whether it was Mrs. Lovett's idea. She's only depicted as this demonic presence who terrorizes her cook from the cellar. And then it's also later disclosed that she's essentially an alcoholic for 8 years after doing this process.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, it's odd to me that, you know, there is so little focus on her. Mm-hmm. You know, because she's, you know, a bit ripe for the analyzing.
Absolutely.
Like, yeah, it's something that's really fascinated me for a while. And it's, you know, interesting that, you know, from the way that you describe it, you know, the way that she presents as being more middle class, you know, as trying to fit into society, you know, is the driving force behind it. You know, it's class.
Well, that's the thing too, is with the Gothic fiction of the period, the predominant readers of Gothic fiction in the early mid-Victorian period were middle class women. So what a lot of authors of Penny Bloods were doing during that time were trying to create their characters within a middle-class setting to kind of draw that appeal to the middle-class readership.
So then it would be Mrs. Lovett trying to rise above her station being, you know, what starts her downfall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because absolutely. She can't.
Right. And that's actually at the end of the chapter I go into talk about that is the moment that she is exposed as a fraud, essentially, she's not the Victorian angel of innocence and hospitality and the queen of domesticity. She's actually a femme fatale character who is pro-cannibalism. When she's exposed, she drops dead. And I don't want to say she drops dead because she's exposed. For those of your listeners who haven't read the story, she was poisoned in the chapter prior to her exposure. But it just so happens that it's perfectly timed when the police show up and she's feeding them human flesh. She drops dead right on the site.
Yeah, it just happens to be perfect timing. Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, if you're going to do something for ultimate drama, you have to.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I thought that it was brilliant, the way that your monograph ends with the focus upon the she-wolves, because they are a pretty darn perfect amalgamation of everything that you've described before. And I think it's particularly interesting to look at them, because in modern times, so many of the writings that have been done, the literature, the screen depictions that we have upon werewolves are male.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas earlier, the she-wolves were much more predominant.
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because that's exactly the way I structured my text is I wanted to scaffold it in a way where they start off as lesser monsters and then transform into the fuller monster. So I thought it was a perfect point to end it with the she-wolves.
I really liked the gray wolf in particular.
Yes.
MacDonald is the author of that, and it's a bit of a twist on the wolver stories.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about that for our listeners?
Oh, sure. The Grey Wolf was actually a moment for me, which I was so thrilled. I was searching for that one perfect text to fill up the She-Wolf chapter. And I was actually doing some research on the wolver. And I was looking at, was it a text from 1932 by Jesse Wixby? Don't quote me on that. But they started talking about the wolver and how the characteristics came about because, this folklore came about because of the Nordic invasion into Scotland and the Orkney Islands. I don't remember the exact year, but they were talking about that and how the wolver came about as kind of this figure who was almost barbaric, who lived in the woods, but wasn't a true depiction of a monster. In its appearance, it was considered a monster. However, it also it was helpful to people that were lost or people that were hungry. And then they also talked about how the wolver primarily lived in caves. And when I was reading this, I'm like, why does this sound so familiar to me? It was in my head and it was bothering me. And I'm telling you, for weeks, it was bothering me. I was fixated on it. Well, it just so happens that it was from a fairy tale that I read when I was a child. And lo and behold, when I went digging through my bookshelves, I came across MacDonald's Grey Wolf. And that was my aha moment. So the gray wolf, while she's not exactly a wolver, I mean, first and foremost, she's a she. So it's essentially a very, very short story of a young English gentleman who gets lost on these islands. He's separated from the group of people that he was originally with. He comes across this cave, and around this cave, he sees a young woman. The young woman has no name. She is just referred to as the young woman throughout.
Mm-hmm.
He sees that she's dirty. She's disheveled. Her clothes are torn. She's very waifish, almost sickly. And she leads him to her home. And in her home, he meets her mother, who takes him in. She's apprehensive about it. She takes him in. She feeds him. She cares for him. And at one point when he's trying to sleep, he's woken up by fangs at his neck. He wakes up to find out that there's a wolf in this hut trying to eat him. So he fends the wolf off. The wolf takes off. Ultimately, it comes to fruition that the wolf is actually the young woman. They are banished on this island from society. And the mother has gone there to care for her daughter. So with the mother's assistance, the young English gentleman gets away, and the story concludes with the young woman standing by the cave. And as he walks away, he hears a deep mourning howl. So it was a perfect story.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. It's relatively easy to find online. If anybody's interested, it will literally just take a couple minutes to read because it is so short.
Yeah, I think like 10 minutes maybe.
Yeah, but it's an amazing read because there is a lot wrapped up in it. Mm-hmm. You know, for one, it's just a really interesting, you know, piece of folklore that's being delved into. But for another, just the images in it are haunting. And mm-hmm. the way that it depicts the, you know, woman in particular and how she works with the environment itself. Mm-hmm. There's a really good description in it where she's walking barefoot, you know, through the forest, and he's amazed at like the silent footfalls, you know, through it, just how easily she's navigating.
And he talks about how she's very, very feline, is very cat-like walking through the woods. She's not making any sound. She's has a very lithe figure. So she's almost kind of like fluidly moving.
And she doesn't meet his eyes, which I thought was a really nice detail there as well.
Yeah. And there's so many things wrapped up in that text. And the primary reason that I used it is because all throughout my monograph, I talk about women in nature and mm-hmm. how they're forcefully, they're supposed to reject their instincts. They're supposed to reject their nature. The only nature they're supposed to give into is their reproductive nature. Okay. To further society. So throughout the text, I talk about what happens when these women start rejecting their nature and what ultimately happens to them. So we have the mad woman who rejects her instincts. She represses her sexuality. She represses her desires. And ultimately what happens to her, she either, in the case of Kathy, she dies, or in the case of Bertha Mason, she's locked in an attic by her husband. And ultimately she dies. Right.
Yeah, so, that's a really good description of that.
So you have that. And then you have the next chapter, you have the criminal femme fatale women who are starting to reject this force ideology. They're starting to give into their own instincts. They're starting to accept their station with nature. But ultimately, in most of those texts as well, such as Lady Audley or Mrs. Lovett, they unfortunately die as well. Then you get to the she-wolves. This chapter is half and half. You have the women, for example, like in Wagner the Werewolf, you have Nisida. She delves into her nature, both literally and figuratively. And at the end, yes, she does die because she indulged a little too much. Then you have the young woman from The Grey Wolf. And I found her fascinating because she is a woman who accepted her natural side. She gave into her instincts. She literally became a figuration of woman in nature. However, she is not terminated. She doesn't die. And the reason for this is because she is not part of society. She was exiled into the forest. So everything culturally is stripped away from her clothes, to the way she lives, to her name, which is taken away. So that is the only reason she's allowed to live at the end. She doesn't kill the Englishman. She doesn't live in society. So that's why she is allowed to continue living.
And she also isn't exactly punished for any of this either. Mm-mm. You know, although she is living apart from society, she doesn't seem particularly unhappy with the choice.
No, not at all. And she's not punished for it because as readers, the only thing that we see is that she did not have any violent transgressions. Yes, she had a moment where she attacked the Englishman. However, she transitioned and they showed her weeping in his arms. She was guilty for attacking him. So throughout the text, she didn't have any fatal attacks. So, which is another reason she was allowed to go unpunished.
Yeah, and she also is expressly showing what's going on within her as well. Mm-hmm. You know, in a really interesting way, you know, by that show of emotion, that's something that we don't entirely get with Nisida in, you know, Wagner, the Werewolf.
Absolutely not. No.
Much more repressed in terms of that, which, you know, is also an interesting thing.
Mm-hmm. Nisida is kind of a sociopathic case study, if you ask me. She's very self-involved. The only person she seems to care for is her brother. Yes, she has a relationship with Ferdinand, but it's more for face value. There wasn't, the way their relationship was written, there was no soulmate relationship going on there. It was more she was indulging because she was sexually attracted to him. And that's probably because of his lycanthropic characteristics. But no, Nisida, she didn't show remorse. She didn't show any guilt throughout. The only emotion that was depicted from Nisida is when she found out she was pregnant by a werewolf. Mm-hmm. It was shock, but we didn't see much of that because I think she passed on shortly thereafter.
Yeah, which is like excellent because the book literally begins with the father's funeral. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with her being so stoic throughout it, you know, while her brother is just overbrimming with emotions.
Absolutely.
You know, which is just, you know, again, it's fascinating to see this, you know, because the women are, you know, to a degree punished for showing emotion. Mm-hmm. You know, we see that with Kathy having too many emotions.
Yep. You're not allowed to express yourself.
Yeah, she's deemed appropriate for a society when she tames all of that down and stops wandering the moors. And then Heathcliff has some very complicated feelings about that.
you could say that.
Yeah. It's, you know, the way things go. You know, and of course, you know, with Jane Eyre, there's an even more complicated thing to be dug into in terms of that with race.
Yeah. And Bertha too, that's, and again, I know Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights are incredibly popular. Mm-hmm. There's so much analysis. There's so much scholarly work about it, but I had to put Bertha Mason in my text because she's the one who actually started my journey into this back when I was an undergraduate student. So I felt she had a place there. I felt she was also kind of apt for analysis or dissection because she is essentially the mirror image of Rochester. Mm-hmm. And I say that just because primarily when I look at Bertha Mason, I look at her sexuality. I look at her repressed sexuality.
Yeah.
And how due to her repression, and this is why she is the way she is. And Rochester ultimately locked her away because he couldn't deal with her tendencies. He locked her away because she was over-sexualized. However, the minute he locks her away, what does he say? He runs rampant across the continent. Like, he does the same thing that she would have done if she was a free person. So I really feel like Bertha was put in there as an absolute reflection of Rochester, which is why she's being punished, because women weren't supposed to feel that way, but it was okay for men to.
Yeah, which is interesting because it is a little bit of a mirror to, you know, Mrs. Lovett with the hoarders in the cellar. Mm-hmm. You know, with Rochester, it's the hoarders in the attic.
Exactly.
You know, it's another thing that's just a physical manifestation of what's being locked within them, you know, things they don't want to acknowledge about themselves. You know, which is made manifest with the she-wolves through the act of physical transformation.
Yes. And what's the moral of the story? Don't repress things.
Yeah. I mean, the she-wolves have it pretty good, considering.
For the most part.
Yeah. Yeah, there's been a bit of a rise in the Gothic nowadays. Mm-hmm. We had spoken about that a little bit before. You know, just last week I was watching The Haunting of Bly Manor, which I thought was a pretty fantastic exploration of the Gothic. And it was really fun to watch that with your monograph in mind. Oh, you know, this is what they're doing here.
Yeah, I do like that. The Haunting of Bly Manor, I don't want to say was one of my favorites because it is a rendition of Turn of the Screw.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of... I don't want to say I'm snobby when it comes to when it comes to it, but I absolutely love Turn of the Screw. I thought it was a fabulous novel, and I really think this rendition of it was really good. I could have done without a few parts,
of course,
but ultimately, I thought it was really good, and I look forward. I can't remember the director's name, but
Flanagan.
Flanagan, that's it. Thank you. He's actually going to be doing his next story on Edgar Allan Poe.
Fall of the House of Usher.
Yes. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that. It, funnily enough, my first introduction to Turn of the Screw was a modern rendition of it in a romance novel, of all things.
Interesting.
Which it was really jarring to read that and thoroughly enjoy it and then pick up Turn of the Screw itself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit of a page turner. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think it's fascinating how many, you know, adaptations are coming out of these things, because there's like Jane Eyre is never exactly out of vogue.
No,
I don't think, but there's been more and more people turning to it. I mean, Wuthering Heights saw a bit of a heyday through Twilight of all things.
Yes. Yes. Oh my God. Both Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights actually was mentioned throughout those, but yeah. You're starting to see a lot more Gothic appear. And even horror itself is starting to resurge again. And you're seeing this in a lot of the Netflix adaptations. Mm-hmm. You're seeing this a lot in young adult literature. There are different versions of the Jane Eyre story or the Wuthering Heights story.
With a little bit less puppy hanging, I think, but
that's always a good thing.
Yeah, it still is just fascinating to me. And, you know, with these modern adaptations, there tends to be a little bit more of an analysis of things like race, you know, I think within it.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that surprised me when I first read Wuthering Heights was the fact that it was never overtly stated that Heathcliff was Romani.
Right.
And I had just had that in my head due to different adaptations making it overt. But, you know, why do you think that so many people are turning to Gothic literature now?
I think that it's becoming more of a focus now because there are so many different, I don't want to say tropes because I feel like I'm just kind of pushing it to the side, characteristics more so, because trope sounds a little bit on the negative side.
Yeah.
There are so many characteristics of the Gothic that are relevant to the events of today. I mean, if you look at Gothic, like you said, for example, Heathcliff, even Bertha Mason from Jane Eyre, you have that whole question of race that's occurring. That was essentially in the 1840s, it was announced, but it was announced in passing. They never fully focused on the concept of race about those two characters. And you know what? Now it's coming to fruition today because people are looking back at those texts and saying, hey, this was a thing. We want to know more. Why wasn't it announced or why wasn't it further discussed? So, and again, the concept of gender as well. You look at the two different gender constructs, you know, the woman-male dichotomy. You look in there and you look at the specific treatment of why were women treated this way? Why was it okay for Heathcliff to hang Isabella's dog and him not be construed as a monster? But the minute Kathy has an emotional display, she's considered, oh, she's a monster. She needs to be locked within her room. So, I mean, there are all these different avenues to explore in the Gothic. And I think that's why it's becoming repopular again around this time frame.
I think it's really interesting. When Little Women came out, Greta Gerwig's movie adaptation of it, there was this whole analysis of gender identity with Joe, which tends to come up a fair bit. But there was one analysis that I really enjoyed that was going into, Joe's idea of, self and identity, by playing all these male characters in the romances and by writing, the chapbooks that she was writing, to look at it through that lens. And I thought that was just great because you do have these female writers of this, but then you have Joe, whose gender is a bit more ambiguous.
Absolutely. And, a lot of adaptations of that too, look at Joe as kind of the new woman character. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with Mina from, I know I'm already dating myself, but the 1990, three version of Bram Stoker's Dracula cast Mina as that concept of the new woman. And from that, people are starting to, they're viewing these, and when they go back and they analyze the text, they're starting to look at the contemporaneous information and the discourses surrounding when the text was written. So I think that's another thing. People are starting to look at what other literature, what other texts, what other information was available around the time that these were written. And they're starting to recognize things that weren't recognized before.
Mina having her heyday is one of the things that forever fascinates me. Mm-hmm. There's been this whole trend of viewing Mina's relationship with Dracula as, something chosen because Jonathan was such a weak character. it just endlessly fascinates me. Mm-hmm. She's an amazing character, and contrasting her with Lucy is just really cool.
Yeah. And if I went into that whole, in my monograph, if I extended it to the late Victorian period, you can guarantee both Mina and Lucy would have found a home within those pages.
Yeah. That's one of the really fun bits of analysis that inevitably tends to come up. But I think that, having it focused where you did allowed some things to come to light that would be new to people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I probably would not have come across Wagner the Werewolf otherwise, and that was a rollicking read.
I absolutely love Nisida's exploration of the island. Yes. It was very taboo for the time period because it was very explicit in sexual detail, which was very strange for the Victorian period.
Yeah, the Victorian period is, there's a lot that's coming out from it that seems to be coming back into vogue. I've seen more people actually reading String of Pearls than I think ever have before, with Sweeney Todd coming back to Broadway.
Yeah, I have my entire class right now. I had them several weeks ago reading The String of Pearls, and it was their first time. Only one of the students ever watched the play. I couldn't tear them away from the book. They had so many questions. They wanted to know why it was so different from the Sondheim version.
Yeah.
But they were absolutely fascinated by it. So I think I created a whole little fan club in my new class.
Yeah, do you think that Victorian literature is coming back into vogue in general now?
One can only hope. Yeah. Because, I mean, the stylization of it is fascinating. The context is absolutely amazing. There is definitely an interest from what I can see. My students really, really take to the Victorian writing style. And it's not, I don't want to say because it's easily accessible, because not a lot of it is, but
Wuthering Heights is a bear when you get started with it.
Yes. And even Wagner the Werewolf, it's a penny blood, but it's still, the writing style does not fit the penny blood characteristics. It's overblown. It's excessive in terminology. There's too many plot points, but it's still a difficult read at times. But I don't know. I think there might be maybe a quasi resurgence of Victorian literature or interest in it.
Yeah, I've seen more interest in it, among some of my friends, over the past couple of years. And I think that there's a lot to be gained by having the patience to get into it. Mm-hmm. Because the style does definitely become addictive once you get used to the different sentence structure, essentially. But I certainly would hope that more people would be reading it.
Me too.
And
I would like to see more of it.
Yeah, speaking of reading it, you had mentioned before that you had some interesting new things coming out. Would you like to share with our listeners?
Sure. Well, recently, my co-editor and myself, Sophie Rain, we had released Penny Dreadfuls in the Gothic, which was with University of Wales Press. It came out in Europe about 2 months ago, I would say. It's going to be available in the States in May at some point. I think it's mid-May. Mm-hmm. And then I have another text that's coming out. It's called Penny Bloods, The Tales of Monstrous Women. It's going to be available through the British Library Publishers. And this takes a little bit of a spin on my traditional work. It's less academic mm-hmm. and analytical. And basically what I did is it's a 10 chapter book specifically focused on both obscure and popular Penny Bloods. And what I had did is I condensed each of the Penny Bloods, whereas the typical Penny Blood or Penny Dreadful can range from very short to several hundred pages, like I said, with varied plot lines and irrelevant data. I condensed them each to focus on the plot line of the monstrous woman in each text. So for those interested in reading about monstrous women and Penny Bloods, but don't want to read 300, 400, 500 pages, you could take a look at this text and it'll condense it into a very short paragraph that just draws out the information of the monstrous woman. And that's going to be available. I believe right now the date is May 26th.
Which seems like a much more accessible way to get into these stories.
Absolutely. It cuts out all the excess and the nonsense.
It reminds me of people reading through Les Mis and wanting to just cut out all of the information about Parisian sores.
Yes. Get right to the point, please.
So where can people find you online if they want to follow your work?
Well, I do have an active website. I want to say I update it frequently, but I lie if I say so. I haven't updated in about a month due to personal reasons, but I'm going to get back to that. You could find me at NicoleDittmer.com. You can also find me on Twitter. My handle is @gothprof. I'm very active there. Or you can just send me a message through my website and I will respond to you as well.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you so much. I hope that we get to talk to you again very soon.
Thank you, Hillary. I really appreciate it and I had a good time.
You can read a full review of Nicole's text in the book review section of the Folklore Podcast website, where there's also a link to her website to be found on the page for this episode. Nicole recorded one of the stories referred to in this interview, The White Wolf of the Harz Mountains, for our storytelling strand, Stories from the Hearth. As we're currently in the process of moving all of the early episodes of this show onto the main podcast feed, I've timed the release of this episode to coincide with the re-release of that story. So you should find Nicole's reading in your podcast feed directly after this episode. If you prefer to listen on the web, then there's a link on the episode page of the Folklore Podcast website to take you there as well. Watch out for some more bonus content hitting the main podcast feed very soon. In the meantime, for exclusive extra content and to help us to keep making the shows that you hopefully enjoy, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/thefolklorepodcast, where you can support us for as little as £1 a month and access a whole back catalogue of member content. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.